Hello and welcome to Season 4 of the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
This podcast is all about elite distance running in the UK.
We're here to give you all the latest news updates around the sport,
as well as weekly interviews with athletes and coaches.
Stay up to date by following us on Instagram and X at Sunday Podcast.
And make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel too, where we post athlete workout videos, shoe reviews and more.
Thanks for listening, and as always, we hope you enjoy the episode.
Okay, welcome back to another episode. Matt, how are you, mate? We've got a great guest on later on in the episode, but we're going to kind of chat through some results first, aren't we?
Well, indeed. Looking forward to catching up with Jess. Obviously, fresh off that fantastic run in Valencia. We break down that kind of confusion over the gun and chip time. A little bit frustrating for her. So listen more about that, her training, and just how she's been getting on. But yeah, so, I mean, mate, we got to just tackle that elephant in the room, the women's record in Valencia. It got a lot of attraction, a lot of hype.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about it. Obviously, I've always been someone that I'm not someone who thinks, oh, every athlete's clean or anything like that. I just think, like, it seems on social media, anyway, we seem to like pick and choose where we sort of kind of throw drugs allegations around. And I just think the drugs allocations can't be based off like purely kind of the time someone runs, because we see breakthroughs all around. Obviously, like, especially like we've spoken before, like the advantages the women have, particularly at Valencia, say, of like being able to run with the men, that's got to count for something as well, you know, like that's got to make a massive difference. We're just seeing kind of the sport develop, and the women's world records are getting closer to the men's in the marathon. So why wouldn't we see that kind of happen in the 10K as well? Because we've seen that women's marathon time come way down.
I mean, I just think women are just catching up in general. Their performance is getting way better.
Obviously, just like the depth as well. Like we've had massive depth in kind of the
depth,
men's.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
But yeah, it's seen improvements. So look, I'm not saying I think all the records are clean and stuff, but I think we need to become careful of just being skeptical about every time someone's fast. I don't know. I think if we're going to continue to enjoy the sport, then we need to kind of take things on face value a bit more.
I feel like we're not appreciating how much difference it makes for a woman to run with that like in that pack. Like when I watched the race, she was just flying along, but she literally had men to her left, to her right. You know, she was running, shout out to people like Jacob Allen and people like that, because she was literally running alongside them. And obviously at the front of the race, you saw Kip Lima. He didn't have that. The guy was solo after about 4K. Well, he hit the front straight away and he was solo. Jess goes on to say it was a little bit breezy in certain points in Valencia as well. And so that's obviously a lot harder to run and push the limits like the women can. I think on the road, I actually think road races are probably quicker for women. There's way more depth thanks to running in with the men. But yeah, I mean, obviously it is a bit of a mind-blowing performance, and time will tell if Agnes Nengetic is on drugs. So we will see. You know, with all the records where they are in the women's distance running, it's kind of in line, to be honest with you. I mean, Segai's world record, isn't it? 14 flat. Like, that's probably going to see a woman break 14 minutes on the track this summer. Mm-hmm. You know, so if a bloke was running 13:55, would we, you know, they're probably capable of a 28:45, you know?
Yeah.
Comfortably. So that's, you know, I just think that's where the level is, and it's in line with the marathon, it's in line with the half. So, and now the 10K is gone. So there you have it. Men's race, I mean, Brit, from a Brit perspective, Zach Mohammed's first Brit home, 28:09, solid run for him. And yeah, then we had a whole crop of athletes. You know, I mentioned Jacob Allen just then. But Jake Smith, you know, all these guys running around that 28 high marker as well. Johnny Davies. So not too bad.
We've come to expect from Valencia, hasn't it? Like it's a great opportunity for people to go out there, race in some good conditions at this time of year. Obviously, we ran last year, like, and it was pretty enjoyable experience, apart from some kind of mess up at the start last year. Seemed like there weren't such issues this year. Obviously, we'll kind of get into the interview with Jess in a bit. And she mentioned there was a bit of pushing and shoving, but I think it seems like there wasn't an incident like there was last year, which is good to see. I just think like I think we obviously did that YouTube video showing the kind of the cost you can do it off as well. We weren't exactly trying to do it on the cheap. I think it is just great opportunity for people to go out there, enjoy their running, and get a good effort in at this time of year. So it's weird. Obviously, you've got people like Jess who pretty much wrapped up an Olympic qualifying time, obviously, like not officially, but she kind of the confidence wise, she knows she can do it again. But then you've also got athletes who we don't know what they're doing it for. You mentioned obviously like Jake Smith. Jake Smith's on his kind of comeback from sort of some injury issues. So it's a really interesting time of year when we don't really know what athletes' kind of mindset is, preparation is going into these events. Because, yeah, Zach Mohammed, for example, 28.09, but he could go and pop something big in the next few months, and I wouldn't be surprised, you know.
Well, see how he gets on at London International Cross. Paulos Surfrau, 28.23. That's not a bad run for you. That's a very good run for him, actually. It's PB. But then I think the rest of the Brits, I think they'll be slightly disappointed because you know you go to Valencia hoping for for an electric time, and although the kind of PB Jack Gray got PB, I think we've come accustomed to seeing. I mean, Telford was one in bloody 28.40, wasn't it? You know, George and Charlie Wheeler, Mark Scott there. So you know, Brits not running as quick as what we see on UK soil. So there you have it. Telford, things probably quicker than Valencia, or seem to be this year. Other results, mate. Anything to mention? I mean, British Athletics look like they have a new sponsor, this Micro Plus. Bye bye Muller, it seems. Something that we should probably talk about: Armagh 5K needs funding. Talk about really, really good events and what they do. I mean, yeah, I think Brooks, who was sponsoring it, pulled out. So they lost about £8,000 worth of sponsorship there. So if you do want to help them out, they got a GoFundMe page. Armagh 5K, that'd be very useful. I think they're doing all right from it. So hopefully we can see the event go down in 2025. Just another result as well. Obviously, Houston Half and Marathons went down. I think Callie Thackeray, 68 mids, a strong run for her. I actually just saw today as well, Lum, that she's announced she's going to do Seville Marathon off the back of her 2:22 at the back end of last year. So, yeah, I don't know if that's a risky move, because from what I've read about the selection policy and I've heard when it comes to the marathon, obviously showing form is quite important. So if Seville didn't go well, is that easier for them to pick someone else? Because they're going to pick they can pick up to two people off the back of Seville on the 19th of Feb. Seville's the 18th of Feb. And honestly, on the women's side, we've got so many women who run the time. I think they will. So I think there'll be one spot up for grabs in, post-London, let's say, when they finalize that team at the end of April. So risky move, but maybe she thinks she can go quicker and kind of really cement her place. But again, then that's three marathons in close to 6 months, presuming she qualifies for Paris.
I think the risky move, though, would also be to, in a way, to leave it in that, like we said at the start about kind of women's in general, then we're talking about the women's marathon in the UK, which is popping off on another level, that actually you take the risk by not going and doing it, because you don't compete. And then two ladies come out and run 2:21, which they could, the way it's going, depending on who's running, they could come run 2:21, and then you've not even put your kind of name in the hat because you didn't race. So, and then you should, you know, say Cali Thackeray's PB is 2:22 from pre-Christmas, two ladies go run 2:21, you've got to pick them.
I think there's something which also says, if you commit to a marathon after that first selection policy, you can be deselected. So if you were to, if she was to do a marathon, if she was to announce she's doing London or something, I don't think you can be selected in that first wave. Or if you do get selected, you can be deselected, and then you're really running a risk if you don't perform at London. So it's a confusing selection policy. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how she goes in Seville. I mean, look, she ran 2:22 on a, you know, quite a low key marathon. So, you know, she might fly. She, you know, she might run 2:20 or 2:20. So it's exciting. So we've got that to look forward to. I mean, Lum, should we get stuck into the episode? Should we talk or break down Valencia with Jess and see how she's preparing and what her plans are for 2024?
Yeah, definitely. Let's get right into this episode with Jess. Obviously, Matt mentioned at the beginning, it was brilliant to chat to her because she kind of, well, she tweeted us straight after the race and said, how's that for a blip or something along those lines, because we'd kind of outlined that maybe she hadn't been quite her best or what we come to expect from her. But it was great to chat to her, obviously, about what that actually looked like and then obviously how she ran that 30:48 time for the 10K. So, or 30:38, sorry, but missed that 30:40 time for the Olympic standard based off her gun time. But we'll get straight into that now. Enjoy the episode. Okay, Jess, firstly, welcome back to the podcast. Great to have you back. Obviously, massive run in Valencia, and you did sort of call us out after the race as well. Was it always the plan to kind of attack that Olympic standard in Valencia?
Yeah, so we decided pretty much straight after World Champs. Obviously, I was really happy with how the race went. Eighth, I was so happy. But the way the world rankings works, it's just quite difficult to base your season off of those. So we kind of knew early on that I normally would do Houston half, like that's always a really big staple part of my winter. But it's the same, literally the same day as Valencia. So we decided this year that we'd have to go for Valencia to try and get that Olympic standard and just to see where I was at. So we kind of planned the whole winter with that in mind. And yeah, so I went to Font early, did the cross country, found the cross country really hard. I don't know whether it's just I've been training more on the road, just feeling a little bit faster this time of year. Still the strength was there, but yeah, like the week before Liverpool, did like 105 miles. So coming into Liverpool was hard. That was a hard, hard run. Then we got the taper right for Eurocross. So went from there really.
One thing that we should probably, you know, talk about the World Athletics qualifying, you know, procedure. You ran 30:39. Is that correct? There was a bit of confusion over what you actually ran because of the gun and chip time. And to this day, do you know if you hit the standard? Because I think you were a second outside on your chip time or gun time, sorry, but your chip time was inside, right?
Yeah. So when I first crossed the line, the first set of results were 30:39. And then my chip time come through as 30:38, which is what I thought it was around. I knew it was close, but I was convinced I crossed the line before 40, or if not, it was 30:40. And then I got the official results through and it's a 30:41. So it was just a bit of a, like, I went for a whole wave of emotions, like thinking, oh, I've done it, to then being like, oh, I'll be close. And then I thought, oh, even 30:40, I think would count. So we got told that. So I was like, oh, well, that's fine. Cause I was like, I definitely crossed the line at 30:40. And then to get the official results as 30:41, I was just like, oh my God. So I've actually asked my agent if I can see like the footage of when I actually crossed the line. Cause I watched it back as well. And I'd stopped running when the clock was 30:41. So I was like, I just want the confirmation that, like, if it's outside, it's outside. But it was just the fact there were three different times. It made it really difficult. So if it's outside, it's outside. But I was like, it's worth just checking and seeing. But yeah, apparently chip time doesn't count. It's off gun time, which is really hard at Valencia when they're trying to stagger the start because you can't get on the front of the line. So yeah, it's one of those things.
Were you aware of this before the race?
No. So I didn't know it was going to go purely off, like, well, I didn't know what the qualifying was for gun time, but we went to the meeting the night before in the hotel, like the race meeting, and they basically said, like, it doesn't matter about pushing because you've all got chip times, so it doesn't matter about pushing onto the start line, like, you'll get your specific chip. And I knew, because my husband was running as well, and he started a minute behind, like, he was in the wave behind. So he had his chip time, but then... So my chip time come through, but yeah, it doesn't count. It's off gun, which is really, especially when you're with the men, because they're on the start line, and rightly so, because they're running a lot quicker than I am, but it means you're pushed quite far back.
So frustrating.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think I've asked to see the photographic evidence. I was like, for the sake of a second, I'm going to ask. But it doesn't really change anything, to be honest. Like, I know I've, like, my PB is 30:38 now, which is great, but it would be nice if that counted for the Olympic time. But I'm in a good place in world rankings. I'm going to do another 10K anyway. We've got Highgate, so it's not the end of the world. It was more just to see if all that training had paid off, which it had, which was nice. It was a nice feeling.
Yeah, definitely. And it's got to give you confidence, whether it kind of counts or not, that you can go and kind of repeat that in the summer. One thing we wanted to chat about, obviously, is some of that training, because as we sort of mentioned and you mentioned on Twitter, like, we kind of said you're having a slight blip, or we thought you were, kind of going through Liverpool, where we've come to expect you to dominate, maybe some of the road races as well, kind of Ribble Valley. Talk us through some of the training kind of through those months, because obviously you mentioned the 105-mile week. Was it a case of purely just heavy training blocks? Maybe it was a measured effort, or was it a bit of both through those races?
It's been difficult. It's been really hard, because I went on holiday to Cornwall in September. So we went to Cornwall and Bath. We just stayed in the country because I was just racing wise. I was just like, oh, you know, right, I'll just try and get a good block in. So we went to Font. That was really good. So I did, I think, a month there, which was really hard, but really good. And then come back and did Cardiff. And I think I was expecting to go to Cardiff and be like, oh, because I'd done 300 mile weeks in Font. I'd never hit 100 mile week before. So then I did three in Font Romeu, and then come down and ran like a 68, I think, the week of Cardiff. And I think the big difference with the mileage, like, I just thought, oh, I'll taper that week. And it turns out that didn't work for me. You know, like, I had to, I think, either back off the week before and then in the race week to try and feel a bit more, because I just went really flat legged at Cardiff. And also, it didn't help I had COVID as well, which I didn't realize at the time until I got home. I just said I felt really rubbish, and luckily we had some COVID tests, I think, like, lying around, and yeah, tested positive, so that wasn't great. And then thought, oh, it's fine, I'll just get back into training for Liverpool. So did 105 mile week, which looking back was a mistake, and my dad and Steve Vernon were fuming, like, when I turned up to Liverpool and was like, oh, I feel really tired. And they were like, well, what did you do last week, like, what was the mileage? And I said, and I think Steve's exact words were, I would shout at you right now if there weren't people around. Like, so I'm still learning. I think in my head I'm like, oh, I'll just get straight back into it, but that's a different, that volume is different than anything I've ever sort of experienced before. So then my dad and Steve and, yeah, my husband Rob, they were very much like, right, we need to back off now. Like, for European Cross, you cannot go into European Cross tired. So we did that and did, like, I think come down to about 80, then hit Euro Cross. And actually on that course, that was probably the best I was ever going to run. I'm not a mud runner. Like, I ran all right in the mud, but that was a different level. Like, I wasn't actually running at points. I think when I uploaded it to Strava, it was like 6:20 miling. So, it was just crazy. But yeah, to come fifth there, that was actually a pretty good, like, I'd say it was probably an 8 out of 10. Like, that was the best I could do on that course, I think. I genuinely don't think I could have finished, maybe could have come fourth, but I don't think I'd been in the medals at all, so at least I went for it. Then went back into training after that, Ribble Valley. Rob's parents actually live at the 8k point on the course, so we thought we'd do Christmas, train through Christmas. You have family and stuff, it's very tiring. It was really nice, but yeah, I think it's hard to keep your routines going. And again, I probably got into that phase where I've been, like, pre-Liverpool, you know, where I, like, just trained a bit too hard and I was, like, fatigued. So we went, I'm lucky to be part of Blackburn Harriers, and they obviously put on the, like, race and stuff, so we wanted to do it. But when I was warming up, I was just not feeling right at all, just feeling really heavy legged, really tired. So we just said we'll do it, tried out some new shoes, which I didn't really respond very well to, so it was a good training run. But it's hard going to a race and not being, I don't know, like, I wanted to do it, but then I think you get nervous about what people think. And I remember warming down and being like, oh, Rob, everyone's gonna think that, like, I'm miles off where I'm at. And he was like, so what, it doesn't matter, like, you know exactly where you're at. And I think that's something I'm learning to deal with now. Like, it doesn't matter what other people think. It's just, we know, like, part of the plan. But it was hard. So then I went away the 10 days before Valencia. Really lucky to know Stuart and Joe Spencer, who own a couple of properties out there in Torrevieja. So I stayed there. And Rob came and joined me the 3 days before Valencia, and then got myself in a good headspace and tapered right. And yeah, it all came out, which was good. But it would have been nice for a second quicker, but it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I picked up there. So obviously, you know, yeah, we made a few comments off the back of that Rebel race. But were you actually flat out in that Rebel race, or were you just kind of like, this is a tempo effort for you?
Yeah, so it was pretty much a tempo effort, not really through choice, I'd say. I just felt like I couldn't really move my legs any faster. So early on, I think after the first 800 metres, like warming up, I was like, this is going to be a tempo effort. So after the first 800 metres, I was like, right, just get round. Like, this will be better than any training session you could do, because I don't think you could push yourself in training. So I was like, right, I'll just do it. And yeah, it worked out well, actually, because it was like, I think it was like 32:40 or something, which I ran, but it was more, I knew I was really, really tired. So I thought, if I can get through the last 2K of that course, because it still goes uphill slightly and the finish is quite grim as well. So I was like, if I can actually get through that when I'm feeling exhausted, then hopefully I'll feel much better when I'm fresh. And actually, when I got to 8K in Valencia, I was like, right, you can definitely do this last like 2K. Just think of it as 5 laps on the track. You can finish that off because you've done it at Ribble Valley when you were like exhausted. So it worked really well from that point. But yeah, I think as an athlete, you do worry like what other people think. And I was like, people are going to be like, oh my, because I knew I had a really good one the year before, but I just hadn't been doing that volume. So I hadn't been as tired.
How important was doing that race itself for then how you structured the training going into Valencia? Because if you hadn't have done Ribble, do you think you kind of just would have carried on in this kind of tired state you're in, just kind of push and squeeze until Valencia?
Yeah, I think so. I'm very much like, I get fixated on training and the mileage, and I just want, because it's in the program, like I want to do it. So just because it's in the plan, it doesn't always mean that I should do it. So Rob was very much, I did a session on a Wednesday leading into Ribble, and was just not where I wanted to be. Like, it hadn't helped as well because of the storms and stuff. So the times were so much further down than what I wanted, but I was just like, oh, I feel awful. Like, I feel really bad. I was like, I'm not going to do Ribble. And Rob and my dad were like, you need to do Ribble, because if you don't do it, you'll train, but you'll run too far either side of training. Like, you'll run like 18 mile long run, you'll do it, and that will just carry over. So we were like, fine, we'll back off. For Ribble, but the week before Ribble again had been 100 miles, and then I think the week of Ribble was like 72. So again, it's that like difference between the mileage, like even though I'm backing off for the race, like it's that flat feeling. And then I think actually the week after was like 83, and then the week of obviously Valencia was a lot lower, like 70, because of the race. So it actually worked out really well. But yeah, otherwise I would have just trained for it and probably jeopardized like Valencia.
How does that compare to the sort of mileage you were doing this time last year? Because obviously you mentioned it's kind of your first 100-mile weeks. What sort of consistency were you hitting this time a year ago?
Yeah, so last year I think I was probably around 80, 90. Like, I think the max I did last year was like maybe a 95, 96-mile week, but I would do it literally like one-off. So I'd do like 85 and then 95 and then back to like 80. Whereas this year, to just keep doing hundreds has been really hard. So I think my sweet spot is probably 300-mile weeks, and then I have to back off, which is hard in the winter, because you just, in the summer, you just can't do that many. Like, you just can't, because there's so many races around. But in the winter, there's quite a lot of like dead time. Like, there's only a couple of races that you're really aiming for. So it's really hard to like taper, like, or put in a week where you're easing off. So that's what I found is just difficult. Or if I have one week where I'm like racing and I go straight back up the next week, and that doesn't work. So this year, I've done about, I think, 16 weeks of training, and I think nine or 10 have been 80 or above. And then the others have been like race weeks. So I think there's been like 8 in there that are 100-mile weeks. So it's been hard, and it's a volume I'm just not used to, but it's I'm getting there, I think.
Well, it's it's really interesting here that you are still experimenting. You're still learning. You're still looking, you know, where you can get gains in training, because coming off of the past 2 years you had, I mean, Eugene, although you're 11th, you ran a fantastic, 30, 35 out there. And then last year, you know, eighth in the world champs as well. So you've had two fantastic years, but you're still kind of, you know, turning the screw and looking to, you know, improve and experiment. So how do you weigh up kind of, it must have been tempting to just kind of follow a similar pattern to last year because you had such a successful year.
Yeah, I think it's more me as well. Like, I think I have always wanted to train like three sessions a week, good mileage. And then it's only been when I've sort of been going into championships that we like looked at the training and been like, that's too hard, or, you know, like, make your heart, like, one session can be really hard and all the others have to be like controlled efforts, or the runs have to be a lot slower. And it's something that I just didn't really pick up on. And then this year I thought, right, we'll just go to two sessions a week, because the mileage is so much higher in the winter, and just see how I respond to it. And if I don't like it, then I'll go back in the summer and go back to what I was doing. But yeah, I found it's actually worked really well. Like, the sessions, it just means that the sessions are hard. Like, when I do them, they are hard, or like they're really high volume. So it, actually doing three sessions a week, I just don't think I could do at that volume anymore. So I've sort of substituted one out for like a run and strides instead, and then keep like two sessions in there, and then the high mileage. And it seems to have worked really well, actually. Like, I think more of the speed stuff, like, I found it hard on the cross, because I think whereas before, my technique and things, I kind of really worked, I was like grinding out a cross result, whereas now, like, we've done so much more in the gym. So I do like two gym sessions a week now, which is like really focused on technique and like getting that power and like my positioning in the right place, which has been great. But I think when I was going onto the grass, I was like, what on earth? Like, I can't run how I used to run anymore. Like, I'm just not getting the same power back. So that was hard to sort of trust in that it was going to work. But when I got onto the road at Valencia, I was like, oh, maybe this is what all those months of gym work have like come down to. So it's been nice trying new things, and it's exciting as well, because you think, oh, maybe there's some more like development like I can do as an athlete, and maybe try and get closer to those top fives and things. So we'll see. I mean, it'll be interesting this year and just see how it sort of develops, but I've learned a lot, and I think it's just being patient as well.
So, you know, the winter's changed quite a bit, but I would have thought you've got that summer period now, like pre-championships, almost nailed, considering past two championships, it's been extremely hot for a 10,000 meter runner, and you've performed very well. You clearly enjoy the heat. And I think Paris, you know, is going to be similar weather conditions as well. So are you going to kind of stick to that same plan you've had going in, you know, that 4 to 6 week period before you go into a major champs?
Yeah, that's the plan. Obviously, it'd be like, I really want to qualify. I want to do everything I can, but I think it's more as well with the mental headspace getting away before. That's why I went away as well before Valencia. It's just getting yourself in the right headspace, because I find that I do have a lot of doubts leading into it. Like, you do doubt yourself as like, am I in the shape I'm in, especially this year, like this winter. I was like, I've had no real results, maybe apart from Eurocross, that is what I'm doing in training, it's just not translating into races. So it's difficult. So it's more just going away. So like before Budapest, going to St. Moritz and just getting in the right headspace, training in the heat, but also having that recovery time, and just not doing much around training, you know, like training, going home, resting, having physio, going to the gym. It's all on your doorstep. You don't have to do anything. You're in a really good place. You've got people around you. It's something that I'm actively like wanting to do, because I just know that those like extra couple of percents are going to come through from that like environment, and also being around like-minded people as well. You know, everyone's there preparing to run well. And I think especially in Budapest, I think I was the first final, and I was like, oh my god, like there's so much pressure, like please don't just bomb out and set the team up really badly. So it was really nice to sort of be like, right, we're all in this together, go out there and have a good run and sort of set it up well for everybody else to sort of go on. And well, yeah, they ran so much better. So it was one of those where it's like, it was just nice to be part of a team and feel like I sort of played my little part in it.
Yeah, definitely. And we're really excited, obviously, to kind of see you make that team and then hopefully produce another great performance at the champs. One thing I wanted to ask you about as well from that Valencia race, obviously you had a great performance and even just your 5K split going through in 14:55, kind of, it must be extremely kind of pleased with that as well, kind of showing your speed, maybe some of the gym work. But what was it like just being part of a race like that, particularly where kind of you obviously had a women's world record go as well? What's it like being part of a race that's that fast?
Yeah, it was hard because I think before I thought like there were going to be people around that I knew. So like Carolyn Grovdal, like Nadia Batocletti, I think they were down initially to race. And I was like, that's perfect because they start off a bit slower, they come through. And then the night before I saw like the actual like entries and I was like, damn it, they're not there. So when it started off, it was so fast. I think I went through the first K in 2:50. And I was dropped, like I was out the back door. And I think it's one of those because you have the sub elite men and the men, like elite men, and then you have like obviously elite women, sub elite women. But that's it. Like, and then the people that I would be running around, like Rob and like people like that, they're a minute behind, like they're starting in the wave behind. So actually, if you don't go with it, you're on your own. So it was one of those where I was like, right, go with it. We had the wind behind us as well, but don't go like stupid. And luckily there were no clocks because I think if I'd have seen my 5K split, I'd have been fuming or starting like panicking and being like, I'm not going to hold this together. But yeah, I think I only went for a really rough patch around 6-7K into the wind because as you come back, the wind was in your face a little bit. And then managed to sort of rally at the end and thought I'd done it. But even so, it was a massive PB for me. But then when someone said what the winning time was, I just couldn't believe it. But then I also did believe it because I thought, it was so fast at the start. So it made me feel better that I couldn't keep up because I just had no idea what was going on.
God, you must have been surprised afterwards with how you coped with the 250K because, yeah, that's outrageous. That's what, 14:10, 5K pace, you know, 20 pace.
It was mental. I think we put in to maybe do a 5K in like around March time. We were like, just to see where I was speed wise. But then after that, it was like, don't bother. Like, you know, now like the speed's there and to hold on. And actually that was the worst case scenario for me to run. That we said, the way I run all my best 10Ks are being within myself at the start and then like winding it up. So I think Steve and my dad were like, go through in 15:20. And then if you can, like try and like come through. But just I think the way the race went, the way the conditions were, it just meant that was straight out the window. So I was like, oh, if I can run that in a way that I don't like to run, it gives me a bit of confidence that, you know, if I'm a bit more like easy at the start, feeling a bit more comfortable and come through. And I think I always run a bit better on the track than the road. So again, that was what I was nervous about. It's literally from the gun, it's just go. Whereas a track is a lot more sort of like tactics, or you can wind it up, or you can make up quite a lot of time in the second half. So it's made me excited to do the track, but I don't know if I'd do it again the road. It was just mental, like from the start, the pushing, and then like it just felt like you didn't have a chance to like relax. You were just on it the whole time.
I think that, and that's the key difference, isn't it? When you really get that ultimate performance, it is like that throughout the whole race. Women in general, you know, the world record went down. Obviously, that was a fantastic performance out of this world run. But women in general across the roads, you know, I think it was only equal to, if you look at the World Athletics point system or whatever, it was equal to about a 2:12 marathon and a 62-ish half, which, again, have already been run by women. Any ideas yourself why women are just running so well? They're closing the gap on the men. I mean, me and Lum were kind of talking about this. You know, it was only, 2008 when the steeplechase was introduced in the Olympics. When did Liz McColgan win her first world champs? Was it like early 90s or late 80s? You know, so I guess they just haven't been doing it as long. So do you think the women are kind of up? I mean, you've upped your training, you're training harder and racing's getting a lot more competitive. Do you think that's why we're seeing, you know, the gap close?
Yeah, I don't know. I just, if you'd have told me someone was going around sub 29 at Valencia, I'd have been like, no, I don't think so. Especially the way it was, like, the wind was on the way back. And I think you saw that in the men's race as well. Like, they were starting to tire slightly. Whether it was because, you know, if you get in a good group, I don't know. I literally don't, because I remember thinking, like, this feels fast, but I feel okay. And then when I got told my 5K split, I was like, well, I didn't feel like it. But then I thought maybe it's just because I've got into a good rhythm with some guys around. But yeah, I genuinely don't know. I know a lot of people have said a lot about the shoes and things and that they've really helped like performances as well. But I think it's one of those where I think the shoes are quite individual. Like some people get a massive response and other people don't. And I found that even with like some new shoes, yeah, that I tried for Ribble Valley, I just didn't respond as well to them as I was hoping to. I thought, oh, they look like chunkier and more foam, like I'll be flying. And actually I had the complete opposite effect where I just felt exhausted. And I think it's just the way you ran, it's very different. So I don't know whether some people were just responding really well to that, or it, like, especially when you look at like Berlin Marathon and things like that, those times, they're crazy. Like that is a crazy time. And I think you just have to look at it like for what it is and make it more individual. Like I'm just like, right, if I just focus on myself and I can get to a championship, anything can happen in a championship. Like time trials and stuff are very different, but you look at like, even in the middle distance, like Josh Kerr, Jake Whiteman, like they can win these races. So you just have to sort of believe and like do enough to get there. And then it's a completely different game when you get to world champs. And especially like, yeah, the woman who got the world record, like she was sixth at Budapest. So I wasn't far behind, but you know, like I was nearly 2 minutes behind. So it's one of those, I think you just got to do what you can and then try and get to the championship. And then it's like a level playing field and times don't matter. It's just about racing.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing we just want to ask before we finish then, Jess, what's kind of your plan over the next few months? Obviously, we know you've got kind of Paris in your sights, but over the next few months, what's going to be the plan? Are you going to go away to altitude?
It was very much like I hadn't really planned anything until Valencia, because we were like, well, if it goes well and great, and if it doesn't, then we're like, oh, bugger, like, what has gone wrong? Like, maybe I am having a blip. I was like, you know, it's one of those where you're like, maybe it's just not going as well as I want to. But Valencia went really well, and sort of showed that the stuff I've been doing in training did translate, so that was really good. So I'm gonna do half marathon next month, just because I got a bit of FOMO watching Houston and being like, oh, I'm not there, because I love doing that. So we're gonna do half marathon next month, and then I think I'm gonna do a 10k in March. And just try and get that standard and get it sorted. But if not, also then it's really good race practice, and then I think go to St Moritz in April. That's the plan, is to just get away, hopefully it doesn't snow, and then come in ready for Highgate, because Highgate's so early. I really respect like the 18th of May or whatever. It's just, yeah, it's early, so again we'll base our season up till there, and then we'll have to just like check it and see what, if we've done everything we need to, then great, and if not, then look at 5k half marathon options for like Europeans and stuff like that. So
a bit of a backup there. Presume you'll try and do that. Is it the Sound Running 10k in March? Is that the one? That's the one kind of people try to hit, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think I've always watched it and wanted to do it. And then I think it, you know, it's a lot of travel and things, and you have to like pretty much make a camp out of going there. That's the only problem. So it's like, you sort of have to go and prepare for it. But I think I didn't want to do it if I was like, if I run like 31:30, I'd be like, I'm not ready, you know, like, I'm not ready to go, right. And I don't want to sort of get like my backside handed to me. But I think it's one of those where it's like, oh, okay, I was close, like let's see, it's going to be perfectly paced hopefully, and try and do that. And yeah, I really like the Sound Running guys, like I think they do such a great job of actually making that opportunities for people. And just in the UK there isn't really anything like that here, like that early on. I guess the weather's not favourable here in March, so California is a lot more tempting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we wish you all the best with that, Jess, and thanks very much for chatting to us today.
Oh, no, thank you.
Cheers, Jess.
Okay, brilliant to chat to Jess there, and obviously fantastic performance from her in Valencia. Matt, one thing for me, and I think you mentioned it as well, is kind of the, even though she's been at this elite level, like you're talking top eight in the world for the past 2 years, she still managed to provide a significant increase to her training. Because I think going from 80, 85 kind of regularly to 100 mile a week is a massive jump, particularly when you're already at that level, and obviously you've seen the benefits already.
And with what's around the corner, mate, you know, it's a big year, 2024. If things don't go right, that would be a huge disappointment. But things are definitely going right, and I think we highlighted that, didn't we, a little bit in the podcast.
she's really pushing on. She is hungry to, you know, to perform far, you know, run faster, perform better. And for someone who's coming off eighth in the world champs last year, I think she looks at that, and she, I think Jess is growing in confidence in these championship settings now, you know, 11th, then eighth. And I think she's looking this year and she's going, if I call it, you know, get that qualification and you get on the start line in Paris, I think she can get into that top eight, you know, actually break in. Maybe we'll see a fifth, maybe we'll see a sixth, something around that marker, because like she finished up with there, anything happens in these races. And you know, she was two spots off a lady who had just broken a 10,000 meter world record in Budapest. And I do feel like, you know, with the way the sport is at the moment as well, there's such few opportunities, you know, to run 10,000 meters on the track. But Jess takes every opportunity she has. And I think she learns from every single one. She gets used to hurting. She gets used to lapping the track. Whereas, you know, most people do one, you know, one a year, you know, two a year, maybe max. And I think she puts herself out there. She puts herself on the line. I think she's learned from that. So yeah, but interestingly, Lum, you know, we spoke a little bit off air with her, and you know, obviously her dad's still coaching her closely, but they do kind of, and I think a lot of British athletes now do this, they send their training over to Steve Vernon, who kind of looks over it, and I think British athletics are getting a hold and really supporting of those top athletes, those world class athletes. And we've got an interesting guest coming up next week with Chris Jones, and he kind of followed up and backed that. And he said, you know, that's something they're trying to do is make sure that there's no stone left unturned, and they are doing everything they can. And so I think it's good that Jess is getting another pair of eyes on her training, because it's clearly working.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that the culture is almost shifting from trying to take these athletes away from their kind of original coaches and pushing them towards a BA coach to actually working with the coaches, for example. Yes. And I think 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, that was almost the talk on the ground. Like, I don't think BA would admit to that, but I think the talk on the ground was actually people are encouraged to go and go to these hubs, but not just go to the hubs, like they weren't hubs as it were, but we know what we're talking about there. They're encouraged to go there and kind of get in with a coach who was considered to be in with the crowd. Whereas now it seems like, anyway, the culture shifted to a bit more of a, actually, we're going to work with you. We're going to appreciate all you've done for the athlete. We're going to appreciate how you have that relationship with them, which is so important, but we're going to give you the scientific backing, whatever else it is that you need. We're going to give you help with your coach mentoring. And like you mentioned, Matt, obviously Chris Jones coming up next week to chat about kind of that race or endurance strategy, sorry, for the people just under that kind of world-class performance program. So that'll be really interesting to look forward to that. Yeah, I think as well, just on Jess as well, I think we've spoken about, say, like Ailish in the past couple of years, that our Ailish can really kind of make the jump. And I think someone like Jess must look at Ailish and think, actually, yeah, Ailish, phenomenal athlete, but if she can get in and amongst it, like she's proven that she has the capabilities of, why can't Jess Judd do it? You know, Jess Judd's someone that as a junior, we all remember, over 800 meters, was getting to that world-class level. Like, she's not someone that has just kind of come out of nowhere. She's bided her time kind of getting into the kind of 5K to 10K. She's doing some half marathons as well. She's really kind of taking a long time to make sure that as an athlete, she's got the full range and done the hard training at all the levels. So I don't think it's any surprise to anyone that kind of knows her career that she's really starting to still improve, you know?
I think something which I enjoy hearing from Jess, and she's always very honest about, actually, you know, she does have self-doubt. You know, she spoke about going on these camps, pre these big races, pre Valencia, pre world champs, where, you know, it's more to kind of get her head in the right place, because she, you know, she does have self-doubt. And look, you know, she was open and honest about Ribble as well. Like, although it was a training effort, you know, she was kind of concerned, and you know, and athletes do go through that, just like everybody else out there, you know, just because they're at the top of their game doesn't mean they don't have self-doubt and kind of worry and stress about their training. But I think what they're very good is at doing, and I think Jess must be exceptional at doing it, is actually moving on. One performance like that at Ribble, and you know, she's feeling tired at that stage in the season, she's in a bit of a rut, but clearly, you know, she, couple of weeks later, she's running 30, 30, 38, 30, 39 in Valencia. You know, one of our best times ever. So, you know, and they go away on a camp and they just sort their head out and boom, you know, they're ready to go. Obviously, it's not quite as easy as that, but it's nice to hear that, you know, she's just like everybody else in that sense.
Yeah, and just like everyone else, but obviously kind of that pressure's just heightened even more. Because I even think about, like, say, like you or me, Matt, like when we were racing, like if we run like, what, 90 seconds off our PB, we're thinking, oh, okay, we're screwed now. We're way out of shape. What are we going to do? There's no way in 2 weeks I'm going to come back and PB. You take that, but you're someone like her, where actually, realistically, no one cares what we run. Whereas she's getting people like us on podcasts saying, oh, Jess Judd's not in shape. And she's got everyone looking at the results thinking, oh, Jess Judd didn't have a great one today. She's got all that pressure. But then, I don't know, I'm sure you as listeners have gone through the same, where you feel the pressure on yourself. And it's only you that actually cares about the result, maybe your mum, dad, partner, whatever it is, and a few of your mates. But like when you've got actually everyone looking through the results and thinking, oh, why is Jess Judd so far down? The pressure must be ridiculous. And then to come back and pop off in Valencia like she did, I think it's just brilliant. It says a lot about her character and her confidence as an athlete.
Yeah, so there you have it. I mean, looking forward to seeing what she can do. Sounds like she's gonna go run in California, maybe at that sound running meet, and then obviously Highgate as well. Interestingly as well, like, because of what she went through in Valencia, like, you know, sub 15 minutes, she doesn't need to go run a 5K now. And I think this is what elites do as well. They just have that adaptability where, you know, they do just change their plan, and she's now just very confident in where she's at right now, and rightly so. So, mate, coming up next weekend, well, it's Boston Indoors, so indoor racing is pretty much back. Also, there's a few European meets as well kicking around. There's one in France. I'm commentating one in Germany tomorrow, Saturday, in Dortmund. And then there's a couple in France as well over next weekend, where I think we're going to see quite a few Brits open up. So, and that Boston Indoors, I can't find a start list for it yet. I'm really keen to actually look who signed up to that, because, well, we know a few Brits doing it. Jack Rowe, Wheeler Boys are doing it, but it's more of a case of, you know, what elites are going to go into that one. So how fast is that A section going to be? Obviously, the Valentine invite, what, 2 weeks after or 10 days after, whatever, 10th of Feb, is going to be super strong as well, we expect.
Yeah, I think the Wheeler Boys might be doing that second one, you know, but I can double check. But I think, yeah, we'll make sure you take a look for our kind of Instagram, because we'll probably post those start lists as soon as we get them, if we can, as well. So make sure you kind of look out for that. Yeah, Boston's an interesting one, isn't it? We know the track's quick. We know it's kind of, it almost, even if the track's not quick, whoever goes there is going to get that placebo bonus. And I think that's as good as anything sometimes. But like you say, it's going to, in previous years, it does take sometimes like a, okay, BTC, we're all going to show up. That's what really makes it go as well, because you can't just have the meet and not the athletes. Because say like a load of Brits go over there, but none of them have actually run 13:10 before. You can't then just go and expect to all do it together. You take someone who's already a 13:0 guy to be pushing the pace for kind of a 13 flat, sub 13, to then drag everyone else around. So not a guaranteed kind of rite of passage going to Boston to run those times without some athletes who've been there before and know what it takes to be in there, I think.
And also, I think with the December Boston meet seems to be getting bigger and bigger. Every year that meet gets faster and faster, to a point this year, what, Graham Blanks won it 13:03. I think a lot of the collegians hit that meet in December. They get their NCAA qualifiers, whereas a few years ago, this weekend and a couple weekends time for the Valentine meet, that was where all the best NCAA guys would go. They would bank their qualifier and get ready for indoors, but they're banking their qualifier in December now. So I actually don't expect to see too many high profile collegians go to these meets, just on the basis that they don't, you know, they don't need to. The ones who are going to go to NCAAs probably don't need to go, and they'll save themselves, because we know they've got a busy few weeks coming up with their, what do you call it? They're conference champs.
Conference champs, yeah.
Yeah, conference champs. So we might not actually see crazy depth. I mean, we probably will, won't we? I don't know what I'm talking about here, but you know, that's worth noting. Those NCAA guys who are hungry to run 13:30, 13:20, they've already done it now.
Yeah, and I do think as well, like you say, the top schools in the nation that are able to kind of send all their best athletes there because they have the money probably did it before Christmas. So it's a bit of an unknown until you're there. Obviously, there's going to be fantastic athletes there. And if we see some crazy fast times, I will not be surprised, as in previous years, become accustomed to seeing it. So I'm sure there'll be a random NCAA athlete you've never heard of who'll run sort of like a low 13. And I'm sure some pro will break 13. But hopefully it's good for our Brits, because that's what we really care about, is getting those Brits in the standard so that actually we have some 5K representation this year at some of our majors. Okay, so that's pretty much it though, isn't it? Obviously we've got area champs for cross country. Difficult to kind of predict those as always, because we don't really know who or where people are at with that sort of stuff. I think that's something maybe that if these sort of area champs, and I think they should, I would like them to survive. I think if they're going to survive in this increase of kind of commercial races and things like that, this needs a bit more hype around them. Obviously, we can do the best we can as a podcast. I have some responsibility over that sort of thing. Obviously, we try and predict the national cross, but look, in future, I don't know, if anyone's listening who can get us kind of start list for those sorts of things, then we'd be happy to promote those sorts of races, you know.
I think they're out. They're just, you know, they're obviously just massive. And a lot of clubs, we see it time and time again, just enter like everyone.
That's what I mean. It's not a start list. Yeah, they enter everyone on the cross list. So,
yeah. But with Southerns, Midlands, Northerns, we've got the London International this weekend where athletes are actually representing these regions.
Mm.
Let's say next year, can we push hard with the fixtures? You know, Eamon Martin said that last week, but could we push this international meeting back a few weeks and actually just say, look, right, there's a South of England vest up for grabs, but you got to go run the South of England and win it. Like, to me, that just makes so much more sense. Instead, you know, obviously this international meeting is the week before and they've picked a team off of probably people who have sent in their interest and, you know, a little bit based on form. And again, obviously that's fair enough with the circumstances this year, but can there just be a little bit more structure around it? And I think doing things like that, this international meet grows, people are going to be hungry to compete there. They're going to be hungry to put their regional vest on in the future at this meeting. And why not actually have a qualification for it and say, look, yeah, if you come top four at the Southerns, Midlands or Northerns, you've got a vest up for grabs, and actually earn that vest rather than firing off a few emails and you know, the selectors just whittling it down and just saying, yeah, you look like you're the best informer at the moment, here's a vest, you know, because from a kind of sub-elite angle, there's always quite a lot of politics and people
mate,
thinking 100%. They deserve a vest over others as well.
Yeah, and let's look back, like when we were kids, like what was the best events to go to? Was it English schools and inter-counties? And you qualified by doing your county schools or your county champs. And what was great about those events, there was always someone on that team who didn't even realise it was a thing, who literally like crossed the line in eighth or whatever it is, got given this letter, right on the line, you're still kind of freezing and muddy, someone just hands you a letter. And they're like, hey, there's a inter-counties cross-country? Oh, class, you know? And I just think, yeah, this business of being like, oh, yeah, to run for England cross country, for example, you have to express interest weeks prior to events. I remember, when was it? Bucks Cross, I think, for the World Uni Games a few years ago. There was a guy who came like sixth or something who had no idea about this and then couldn't get selected for World Uni Games because he hadn't expressed interest, even though it's like, how bonkers is that?
I remember that, actually. Yeah, that was back in the day when we were doing Bucks Cross. Yeah, I know, it's frustrating. Just make it a bit more black and white. Doesn't need to be complicated.
Especially internally. We're not sending anyone like abroad or anything like that. All you have to do is tell them where to get a bus or meet at the venue or give you a vest, whatever.
Exactly. So yeah, there's that. I mean, so we can look forward to both those things next weekend. And obviously we'll be bringing you a big old review of that London International Cross. And then just finally, Lum, A little bit more news. I noticed that European Athletics are going to introduce prize money at the European Championships. It's not prize money like at the Worlds where people get, you know, money for each discipline. They've got 500,000 euros, I think, and they've just put disciplines into categories. So, for example, distance is all one. From 800 to, I think it was 5K, 10K, is all one. So the person who has the best performance, I think it's just going to be scored on maybe World Athletics points. They'll give £50,000 to, €50,000 to. So there is prize money, but it's only going to go to one person per like event category.
That one man and one woman, or like will they combine those? So like the best
one woman, man and one man. Woman. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay.
See, that's a good point, actually. I presume one man and one woman, but actually.
Because if you do it on points, you could. Like,
I think
could
it is just... one man and one woman, because I think there's five categories. So.
Okay.
So yeah, because you think you got prizes. The sprints, that's all one. You got distance, that's all one. Then you just got jumps and throws. Yeah. So and then there must be
Or we're missing them. We don't know athletics. Surely there must be something. Then there's five categories. Road maybe is road different because they have them at Europeans. So maybe like walks and marathon might be separate. Matt's doing his stat checking, so we'll let him double check on that. But yeah, I think any sort of prize money, even if it's not in the traditional format, can always be a good thing. Let's hope it goes off some ranking points, because I think
it's road and combined events, mate. So that's the final category. So just the jumble of the walks, the half marathon, and the heptathlon.
Class. As I was saying, I think prize money can only be a good thing, and let's hope it's off the kind of points rather than off like someone just voting for that stuff, because I think 50 grand is a lot of money to throw around for someone to just make a decision like that.
It's good to see there's a bit of money to go into European champs, because again, if that grows over the next few years and athletes can actually start to earn money off, I mean, I think it's crazy you can come fifth in Europe and not earn a dime. Like, it's crazy. So fingers crossed. Anyway, man, that pretty much wraps up this week. And so we'll look forward to catching you next week.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.